First, the Chekhov of the suburbs, John Cheever. Cheever's short stories rank among the most acclaimed achievements of 20th century short fiction. They chronicle the lives of people struggling to find themselves and their place in the world, much like Cheever himself. Blake Bailey's the author of the new biography, Cheever, A Life, and as Bailey tells Steve Paulson, Cheever left a lot of research material for Bailey to review.
He probably kept the most exhaustive record of his inner life of any writer, certainly any American writer of the first rank in the 20th century. And by that, I'm referring to his journal, which in its entirety is over 4,300 single-space type pages. So you have this constant counterpoint between the often pompous, quasi-aristocratic pronouncements of the public Cheever, he would talk like this, it was a completely fabricated accent, and the inner man who was tortured and terrified most of the time. I think that makes for an interesting narrative.
Sure. What was he particularly tortured about?
What he was particularly tortured about was that he was bisexual, that he had a ravenous libido, and that he was living a rather blatant lie. Cheever was born in 1912 in Quincy, Massachusetts, the home of the Adams family. 1D, not 2. I'm not referring to, Lurch and those guys. Henry Adams, in his education, described Quincy as the stoniest and most glacial tidal drift in all the Puritan land. And to be sexually inverted, as it was then known, was to be, at best, a terribly sick person, to be perceived as such, and at worst, to, be committing a crime against nature.
If he was going to be accepted in polite society, he basically had to hide his sexuality.
Right. He desperately wanted to hide his sexuality because Cheever, we must not forget, wanted to be the best there is socially. Cheever is a grand old Brahmin name in New England. Of course, Cheever's own family was from the sort of raffish, discarded branch that washed up on the south shore of Massachusetts. And his father was actually a shoe salesman, at one time a very prosperous shoe salesman. But the shoe industry and the rest of the textile industries in New England were wiped out before the Depression, actually. And the Cheevers lost all their money. And Cheever's mother had to open a gift shop in downtown Quincy. And this was an abysmal humiliation for John. And he spent his life escaping it. He spent his life reinventing himself as this Brahmin, quasi-aristocratic person with a very strange accent. An accent which, Philip Roth said is not even a New England accent. It's more like Thurston Howell III in Gilligan's Island. So, above all, he could not reveal that he was bisexual. And as far as his actual inclinations were concerned, he was mostly just gay. But he sired 3 children, and he was married to the same woman for 41 absolutely indescribably hellish years.
Now, you've said that there was this huge gap between Cheever's inner and outer lives, and he wrote about his inner life, including his bisexuality, in his journals, but not in his fiction. But did this big secret come up in his stories?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is that, Cheever had sort of enjoyed a resurgence of fame toward the end of his career because he published Faulkner, his 4th novel, in 1977. And that is the story of a character very like John Cheever who kills his brother, as Cheever wanted to throughout his life, and goes to a prison, much like Sing Sing. Cheever lived in Ossining for the last 20 years of his life. And there he achieves peace with himself through the medium of a homosexual love affair with this hustler in prison. And, Cheever was mortified by the possibility that this would be regarded as confessional, which, of course, it was. And a lot of people began to suspect after that book was published that Cheever was gay. Now, hints had been dropped in a lot of his earlier work. And, Cheever sort of manfully owned to that on the Dick Cavett Show. He said, anyone paying attention could notice I've written about this many times. And he had, In the Wapshot Chronicle, Coverley has this crisis where he thinks he might be, quote unquote, a fruit. But usually what Cheever does pre-Faulkner, what he does is he turns it into sort of an objective correlative. For example, in his story, The Housebreaker of Shady Hill, Johnny Hake, the protagonist, becomes a thief. And he feels this terrifying shame that he'll be exposed to his, you know, prosperous neighbors as an imposter. So the thief is kind of an objective correlative of the secret bisexuality and, you know, the terror that Cheever lived with daily of being exposed as an imposter. And there are those little objective correlatives throughout his stories. The point is that had Cheever not struggled with this issue, we would be the poorer for it. You know, I mean, his art would have been the poorer for it, because his most common theme is that even the most outwardly decorous people have terrible secrets that they're at pains to conceal from the world.
Let's talk about Cheever's fiction. He's best known for his short stories. And he's, even though he did write some novels, but he's sort of, I think, thought of to this day as being essentially a short story writer. And he had some great stories. One was The Enormous Radio. Can you explain what happens in this story?
The Enormous Radio was probably Cheever's first great story. It was published in 1947. And nothing that preceded it really sort of signaled this weird turn that his fiction was going to take into surrealism, into sort of almost Kafkaesque deviation from, you know, the prevailing naturalism of the time. It is a story about a sinister radio that transmits the private lives of people who live in this apartment building near Sutton Place.
So suddenly this couple can dial around on the radio and hear and eavesdrop on all these conversations happening in other apartments around them.
They left the table and took their coffee into the living room. Irene asked Jim to try another station. He turned the knob. "Have you seen my garters?" a man asked. "Button me up," a woman said. "Have you seen my garters?" the man said again. "Just button me up and I'll find your garters," the woman said. Jim shifted to another station. "I wish you wouldn't leave apple cores in the ashtrays," a man said. "I hate the smell." "This is strange," Jim said. "Isn't it?" Irene said. Jim turned the knob again. "On the coast of Coromandel, where the early pumpkins blow," a woman with a pronounced English accent said, "in the middle of the woods lived the Yongi Bongi Bo. 12 chairs and half a candle, one old jug without a handle." "My God!" Irene cried. "That's the Sweeney's nurse! These were all his worldly goods," the British voice continued. "Turn that thing off," Irene said. "Maybe they can hear us."
So why do you think he took this surrealist turn? I mean, sort of, you know, this weird radio that could, you know, reveal everyone's secrets.
Well, in those days and to the present day, to some extent, it's prestigious to say that one is deriving from Kafka, because Kafka is a very, very well-regarded, influential Western writer. So that's what Cheever said. He said, "Yeah, well, I'd immerse myself in Kafka." But the fact is that, you know, as his first girlfriend, Dodie Merwin, pointed out, that's just the way Cheever was called Joey by his childhood friends. That was just how Joey told stories, you know? I mean, he would start out telling you this sort of banal anecdote, and suddenly he'd go off on some weird tangent, you know? And The Enormous Radio starts by just sort of setting the scene. There's this couple. They're very average, except they have this extraordinary love of music, so they get this elaborate radio. And suddenly, you know, diabolical crackling noise comes over the radio, and suddenly all this weird stuff is happening. Well, that's just the way Joey told stories. You know, he was an extremely original person. Let me say this. The writer Wilfred Sheed said that with Cheever, the faculties of memory and imagination are not two different faculties, but one meta-faculty, so that experience for Cheever is immediately refined into the stuff of fiction. His son Ben said, "My father would start to walk across the room with a screwdriver in his hand, and by the time he got to the other side, it was a pair of pliers." You know, I mean, even as an 11-year-old child in Quincy, he was legendary for his storytelling prowess. You know, his teacher would tell him to stand up and say, Joey, tell us a story. And immediately, spontaneously, the raw materials would synthesize and out would come a story without his even having to think of it. And he would keep you enthralled for as long as he cared to do so. So it's not deriving from Kafka. It's just being a genius.
So does that mean that he could just sit down and spit out the story? I mean, he didn't have to sort of labor over and over to get it just right?
Cheever was not much of a, what's the word I'm looking for? He didn't whittle his prose very much. He didn't have to. I mean, you have people who do go draft after draft after draft after draft. Bernard Malamud would have 50 or 60 drafts for a single story. Cheever was more of a sprinter, especially earlier in his career. He could really grind it out. You know, I mean, we're talking about a man who wrote many hundreds of short stories in his life, published maybe 250, published 121 in The New Yorker. He was a writer. He was a genuinely inspired writer. That's why he was a short story writer first and foremost. You know, he communed with an actual muse. He would get a Danae, say, you know, the given, the premise. A man swims from pool to pool among his neighbors and on the way learns some terrible things about himself. And that becomes the swimmer, right? Mm-hmm. He'd get that. He'd write it down sort of in the first flush of inspiration, and then it would be done, and he'd want to move on to something else. That's good for a story writer if you can write in that sort of surge of inspiration. It's not so good for a novelist.
Let me ask you about The Swimmer for a moment, another one of his great stories. In fact, this was turned into a movie starring Burt Lancaster. Story of this guy who wants to swim essentially across his county in all these swimming pools. But again, it takes this weird, surrealist turn. Can you describe what happens in the story?
Yeah, The Swimmer is, for my money, it's one of Cheever's two or three and possibly his greatest story. In The Swimmer, Nettie Merrill, a middle-aged man, is, you know, with his hungover neighbors, the Wester Hazies, and he's looking sort of down from there on top of a crest, and he notices that the pools of his neighbors across the landscape form a sort of subterranean river. And he gets the inspired idea, you know, that he's going to swim home. He's going to go from pool to pool. And it's supposed to be a midsummer day, okay? But during his journey, his odyssey, not only do the leaves start to fall, and not only does it start to get cold, but Nettie begins to age. And Nettie, from, you know, goes from sort of the exultant beginnings of this adventure to, you know, these terrible, dark sort of intimations about things that are happening in his life that he doesn't want to admit to himself and that he's forced to face. He keeps encountering people who say disturbing things to him, like, I heard about your poor children, Nettie. And finally, toward the end of the story, he is very old. It's very cold. The constellations of autumn wheel into the sky. And he reaches home, and the place is shuttered and locked and empty. So you have to draw your own conclusions. It is a haunting, haunting story.
He had done what he wanted. He had swum the county, but he was so stupefied with exhaustion that his triumph seemed vague. Stooped, holding onto the gatepost for support, he turned up the driveway of his own house. The place was dark. Was it so late that they had all gone to bed? Had Lucinda stayed at the Westerhouses for supper? Had the girls joined her there or gone someplace else? Hadn't they agreed, as they usually did on Sundays, to regret all their invitations and stay at home? He tried the garage doors to see what cars were in, but the doors were locked and rust came off the handles onto his hands. Going towards the house, he saw that the force of the thunderstorm had knocked one of the rain gutters loose. It hung down over the front door like an umbrella rib, but it could be fixed in the morning. The house was locked, and he thought that the stupid cook or the stupid maid must have locked the place up, until he remembered that it had been some time since they had employed a maid or a cook. He shouted, pounded on the door, tried to force it with his shoulder, and then, looking in at the window, saw that the place was empty.
John Cheever, reading from his classic short story, The Swimmer. We also heard Meryl Streep reading from The Enormous Radio. Both of those readings are from the John Cheever audio collection. Blake Bailey is the author of Cheever, A Life. He spoke with Steve Paulson.